Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Coming up on episode 248 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Toyota Tundra, the BMW iX M60, the Hyundai Sonata N-Line, the Porsche 718 Cayman GT4 E-Performance, the Honda Prologue, Elon Musk's crash course, the Concorso d'Eleganza, the Nissan Sakura, and more of Hyundai's electrified vehicles. All that and more coming up next. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 248 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abul Salmon from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakelin from the Fast Woman podcast over at Newsweek.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from The Thing Gadget.
All right. Nicole, what have you been driving?
Hyundais. Only Hyundais. All Hyundais. Hyundai. All day, all the time. So I had a Hyundai in my driveway. I went to a Hyundai drive program. They swapped my car this morning. Guess what I got?
Another Hyundai?
Yeah. It's a Hyundai. I know. Shocking, right? So I have all Hyundais. What I actually drove last week was the 2022 Hyundai Sonata N-Line, which is the fun Sonata. I mean, all the Sonatas are pretty decent sedan, but the base engine on a Sonata is 191 horsepower. The N-Line, 290 horsepower. It's a pretty big difference. Also, you
that's
get a
more for those keeping track.
Yeah, the math. Thank you for the mathing, Roberto.
Math.
He knows greater math. Than.
He knows greater than. So when you're getting the N-Line, you're getting truly the sporty version. It's not one of those situations where it just looks that way. It actually has the horsepower to back it up. It handles that way. It's fun. I mean, it really is an aggressive and fun sedan. It was funny. I was driving it in heavy traffic and trying to get through this traffic. And my husband's like, well, this thing kind of moves. Like, I think he looked too mild mannered on the outside for him. And he's like, wait, this seems like this is actually a cool car. I'm like, yeah, this is actually kind of the sedan. That's like, yeah, I'm just a sedan. No one buys sedans anymore. Woo, this one's kind of fun. So I enjoy this. And I like Hyundai's. I like the styling, the way they did like the lights on the front, that it kind of travels up a little bit and sort of this little stripe that runs along like the hood and where the fender meet. It's got some great styling. It's comfortable. It's quiet. It does all the sedan stuff. It's comfortable. It's roomy. It's quiet. It has the right amenities inside so that, you know, passengers, who is your focus when you have a sedan, can all, you know, have a nice experience, whether you're just driving around town, whether you're tackling the morning commute, or whether you've got like a genuine long distance road trip. It's nice and roomy. You can get comfortable in this. You've got a choice of three different engines altogether. But if you go with the N-Line, you get that 2.5 liter turbocharged engine that really makes this more aggressive than you think. You don't really think of sort of what looks like this like mild-mannered sedan as being something that's truly fun to drive. It is. And it's also not outrageously expensive, because one of the things that happens a lot of the time when you get into any kind of performance anything, your normal version is a reasonable price. You either do the performance upgrade, whether it's just an appearance thing to make it look sporty, or engine, or both. Suddenly you've broken the bank and it's no longer an affordable car. This one, not the case. It was $34,840 as it sat in my driveway last week. That is not a lot for a sedan. That's a very reasonable price. And this thing had pretty much everything you could want. It's fully loaded. It's not like there's all this extra stuff that you're going to want to add on there. It's got like Bose premium audio system. It has like, let's see, a 12.3-inch digital like instrument cluster. It's got a 10.25-inch infotainment touchscreen. So it looks every bit the upscale car inside, with little bits of red accents all over the place, because where orange means you're ready to go off-road, red means you're ready to go fast. That's today's color theming in any car. They're off. Their little off-roady versions get orange. Their fast versions get red. So
just out of curiosity, you said that that was the price as it sat in your driveway. Does that price change when it leaves your driveway?
Only if you get a ticket.
Okay. So, yeah, it could.
It could.
Plus gas. I think it's a, that's plus a reasonable. Plus gas.
I think the only extra on there, too, for the end line, there was one extra on this. It was $195. It was included in that price that I quoted. It was carpeted floor mats. So, apparently, they sprang an extra, basically, $200. You get fancy end line floor mats to go on there, which I would buy because they look cool. Like if you're going for the whole end line thing, make the whole thing look cool. Get the fancy floor mats. Why not? It's $200. That's practically nothing in the world of, you know,
cars
and delivery. Wait, here's your destination. How much you think the destination was, guys? Guesses.
$1,100.
You're too high.
Really?
$995.
You're too low. $10.45.
Darn it.
Smack in the middle. So
Roberto wins that one by Price is Right rule. So
he does. He wins
$1.
He wins by Price is Right rules. I generally feel pretty positively about most of Hyundai's vehicles. Like there's little quibbles here and there, but I like their vehicles because I feel like they manage to pack everything you want into the car. It does what it's billed to do, whether it's an SUV or whether it's a sedan or whether it's something sportier like a Veloster. It does what it's supposed to do at a price that makes it still affordable. And you're not sitting there thinking, I thought I was getting one thing. I got another. Or to make it really what I want to make it, I've got to add on $10,000 worth of random bits and pieces to make it seem like the car they're trying to sell me. So I liked the Sonata N-Line. I'm a fan. Have you guys driven it?
I have not driven the Sonata N line.
Okay. Just the regular old Sonata. Yeah.
Just the regular old Sonata.
I have done the Kona N line, and that was fantastic.
Fantastic.
So, I was supposed to have a Kona N line this week, but they swapped it at the last minute. Hyundai apparently needed it for something, and so they sent me an Ioniq 5 instead.
Okay, that's not a bad swap. Trade. Yeah, I feel like you. Swap. I don't think you suffered
that's
for that
that's trade, really.
So that is basically the lowdown on the Hyundai Sonata N line. If you're looking for nice, roomy sedan, but you want to have a little bit more oomph than what you have in the rest of the Sonata lineup, because there's 191 horsepower base engine, on the SE and the SEL, there's a turbocharged engine. So you get the turbo thing that's 180 horsepower that you can get. And then there's this 290 horsepower, 2.5 liter turbocharged four cylinder. This is the fun one. This is the one where the fun lives. But I also, it's all Hyundai all the time, spend some time in Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm really sad I didn't get any Nashville hot chicken. I feel like I missed the boat. I did not get that while I was down there. I did get biscuits and lots of jelly at Loveless Cafe, which was delicious. But we were driving all the electrified stuff. It was just an electrified drive program. So we had the Ioniq 5 that you have sitting in your driveway, Sam. We had a Kona EV, which you have sitting in your driveway all the time, Roberto. And then we also had the Tucson and the Santa Fe plug-in hybrids. And we did it on a drive route where it was only a 1 day program. So we got like a small amount of time in each one. So you took those four cars and you divided them up over one drive route. And the idea was really just to sort of showcase all of their electric vehicles. We've talked about the IONIQ 5 a lot. Sam, I know you're going to talk about it more. I like the IONIQ 5. I think it's good. That Kona, though, man, that thing was fun. Now I know why you drive that, Roberto. That was a fun, that's a fun little car.
Did you say it's fantastic?
It's fantastic. I don't know why I was just, I was like, okay, fine, whatever, I'll drive the Kona EV.
Roberto's got bad opinions on lots of things.
He doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't know why I even listened to the guy, but okay, fine, I'll drive the car. And I drove it. It was really fun. And I had it in this, like, it was blue. I don't know what the color was, but it was so bright. It was like you needed sunglasses to look at this blue. This is really, really bright blue. So it was striking. You could find it in a parking lot. So, you know, the IONIQ 5, great. Like, they say it's an SUV. I don't know. I'm going to argue. SUV, crossover. It's in that small, squished SUV category.
It's just a big hatchback.
It's a big hatchback. I like that.
But if you call it a hatchback, nobody will buy it.
Correct.
Yeah, but we know what it is.
Yeah. If you call it a hatchback, no one's going to buy it. But basically, that's what it is. It's a big hatchback, and it does that great. The Kona is actually a wee tiny little thing. It's really fun. I thoroughly enjoyed driving it. We had some nice little twisty roads they put us on. Outside of Nashville. And then the Tucson and the Santa Fe, the plug-in hybrids, they were good as well. I think the thing that you walk away from most after spending time driving four different vehicles, two plug-ins, two EVs that are, you know, it's not like this is an EV company. You know, this is a company, they build all kinds of cars and all kinds of other stuff that you walk away thinking it's neat to see that electric vehicles or electrified vehicles don't feel different in weird ways than just driving something with a gas engine. You know, you get more torque when you hit the gas or hit the accelerator on an EV, that sort of instant torque. But you don't think about the fact that you're driving something that doesn't have a gas engine under the hood. You don't think about the fact that you're driving on the plug-in something that you can plug in and get, you know, some electric range. The time that you really notice it in all the best ways possible is when you're someplace quiet. You roll down the windows, you're driving on sort of a side road. With an EV, you hear nothing, and it's kind of glorious. And the same thing for the limited amount of range on a plug-in. So I think it did a good job just being on this program of sort of proving that if you think that electrified stuff is still kind of weird and out there, and it's going to be a negative, and it's going to be different enough that you're going to sort of miss the things that you like about driving something that's purely gas powered, you probably aren't going to. I mean, there really is a lot to be offered by all of these vehicles. And this is just from one manufacturer, four vehicles from one manufacturer. And there's EVs coming out from everybody right now. And there's plug-in hybrids coming out from everybody. So I think it was an interesting program. It was neat to see that Hyundai took the time to just say, we're going to showcase just this. This is all we're going to talk about. It's just electrics and nothing else. So I had the, you know, very not electric Hyundai Sonata N line, and then the very electrified everything else. So it was an interesting program, and I appreciated that they gave us the opportunity to drive them.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, that blue is the one we own. We went out of our way to find
it. No way, you have that blue? That blue is awesome. I loved it. I'm like, holy cow, this is bright.
They had the gray and black one at the Hyundai dealership, like, a few miles from our house.
Yeah.
And I just kept looking until I found one. It was like 45 minutes from our house is where the blue one. And so we went all the way out there to get it.
It's really cool. It's such a cute little car to have it in that really bright color. It's awesome. I loved it.
It's easy to find in a parking lot.
Yeah. So you're never going to lose it. You're like, where did I park? Wait, that's me glowing in the corner. There I am. Yep.
All right. Robbie, what about you?
Oh, no, I didn't know it was going to be my turn next. I had the, so I went to Germany, and I drove the BMW iX M60. This is the M version of their iX electric SUV. I drove it around Berlin, then I drove it from Berlin to Munich, and then from Munich all the way down to Lake Como in Italy, where apparently, who's that guy? George Clooney. I guess he lives down there. And then someone was saying something about Kardashians or something. There was a wedding.
I just literally saw that and I was like, hey, I think that's where everyone was doing that little drive program. A Kardashian got married.
Yeah, someone got married down there. I don't know. I don't know about either of those other things, but I do know about the BMW iX M60.
You mean you didn't hang out with George and his wife?
I did not hang out with George. I did drive the vehicle for a very long time. It's an all-wheel drive. It is quick. It is very much a proper SUV, M-powered SUV. I think BMW. I drove the i4 M50 at the same time I drove the regular eDrive i4 40 last year. Anyway, when I did it, I did. And yeah, I think BMW, they've done a really good job with both of these EVs, and they did a really good job making them both M's. It has 610 horsepower. It has a range of about 280 miles, which I tell you that there was no way we ever got that good of range because we're driving on the Autobahn. And because you're driving on the Autobahn and you're American and you're in a sport SUV that just happens to be an EV, you're driving at 200 miles an hour all the time. So we're doing, it has a top speed of, I think it's 250, which is, let's see what they're...
That's about 150.
Yeah, so the electronically limited speed limit is 155 miles an hour, which no one in America should be driving anywhere on the roads. I got this up to 120 miles an hour on the Autobahn. Somewhere around, I would say, 110, 115, it does get a little floaty.
A little squirrely. So you didn't go that much faster.
Not squirrely. It just seems to float a little bit more than you want for something that's going that fast.
I'm a little surprised for an M model that it would.
Yeah.
It's also, it's tall. B, it's heavy.
Yeah.
At some point, you have to I could have gotten it to its 250 kilometer an hour if I really wanted to, but I didn't because no one should be driving the M60 or iX M60 at 120 miles an hour in the United States. And I don't think anyone who buys it in the United States is ever going to get that even that fast. I'm sure one or two people, but for the most part, everyone's going to be doing maybe 90.
Yeah.
I mean, this is obviously going to be people's track day special.
Yeah. No one's going to be tracking the iX M60. It is quick though. I mean, it's 811 pound feet of torque. Which is, yeah, you stomp on that accelerator and it'll tell you, it'll snap your head back. It still has a lot, it's essentially the interior is pretty, it's the same as the iX. It's very future looking. It has the crystal, controls for the door, not for the doors, the crystal controls for your chairs. And then the crystal, that little round
iDrive,
that's a crystal. And when the sun hits it just right, it shoots a rainbow into your eye. it still has that wood area around it. So it has little buttons there and so it looks really classy. There are some weird things that I still am not a fan of with the latest version of the iDrive system, which is on this vehicle, when you hit the mode button in the little wood area, it doesn't go through the modes. It just brings up all three modes on the screen. And then you have to pick one. There's like efficiency, there's like regular, and then there's sport. You have to actually hit one of those on the screen. On the touch screen. And then once you do that, the little background art for that.
Yeah.
That shows up on the screen, and it doesn't just go away and back to, let's say you're using navigation or whatever. It just stays there. Now, you can hit the mode again, and it's supposed to go, but you have to go back and, hit the navigation button and go back to that. It's really weird. I don't understand why that is the way. I mean, I know why it ended up being like that, because it is part of the touchscreen as opposed to just hitting the mode button two times to switch modes. You have to hit it and then go to the touchscreen. Yeah, that's, I don't like that.
I wonder if that's just a pre-production software glitch or something.
No, it was on the iX too. I drove the iX 2 weeks earlier.
Yeah, nice try.
No, it's a thing. But they can do an over-the-air update and fix it because they're going to do an over-the-air update and add two more modes to the vehicle. They're not drive modes. They're just sort of atmospheric modes. Like they'll change the ambient light and they'll change the sounds and stuff. One is relaxation and the other is something else. I can't remember. I think it's like excitement or enthusiasm or something. But yeah, you'll get two more modes that are essentially, I guess, regular mode, but they have different sort of like ambient lights, and you know, when you're driving, it'll make fun noises. If you're a fan of fun noises when your car is driving. But yeah, the steering was nice for, you know, it's still a large vehicle. We went up the Swiss Alps, did some pretty crazy switchbacks on a road that was, you know, it was two lanes, but really just one lane.
one of those roads.
If you ever drive in Europe, you'll one day you'll be on a road and you're like, oh wow, this road's really, really narrow.
Which guarantees a box truck is going to try to pass you in the other direction. Yeah, I'll drive into this ditch. I'm good.
We were going to do we were coming up to a place to do a driver swap, and right when we got there, was another, you know, switchback to get to the buildings, and suddenly there was a Prius. We're like, ah. So it's definitely not a road you can like really just go hog wild on. But we were able to determine that the all-wheel steering does in fact make it easier to get around those roads. Those switchbacks are super, super, super tight. They're far tighter than what you would probably see on a majority of U.S. roads. These were, I don't know how people with bigger vehicles were doing it. It was a good drive. We got to charge it, which is something you never get to do on a drive program. Mostly when you go on a drive program, here's the car. Here's how long if it has, let's say the car has 300 miles of range, they'll give you the car for 220 miles of range, 220 miles. Or they'll like, oh, hey, let's have a nice long lunch, and they'll run off and charge the cars for you, and you'll get back in the cars, and they're all, you know, they got another 20-30% added. On this program, because it was essentially two long days of driving, and we were driving very, very fast because, you know, Autobahn, we got to go to charging stations, and this charges at 195, so it's still a 400-volt system. It's not, you know, I still wish that Mercedes and BMW would jump over to 800-volt, but we got, I think, 185, 189 at one of the stations, so it charges pretty quickly. It's not really that long of a wait. I went and got some weird McDonald's food because I was in another country and I never eat McDonald's. It's still big. It's still the design is still polarizing, and the vehicle still drives really nice. And for the most part, I like the interior. I like the new infotainment system, except for a few little issues like that drive mode thing. It really bugs me.
How much is the M60 going to cost?
Oh, I'm sorry. It will cost $105,100. The destination fee, $995. So that's where you're saving some money. It's even cheaper than Hyundai. $995,000.
It's worth it.
$1,000. Yeah, yeah. Nothing.
And nothing. And what have they said? What the EPA range is going to be?
Yeah, that was the 280.
Oh, okay.
That's their estimated EPA. That's their target. There was no way we were going to get to that. When you're doing 200 miles an hour on the road, you're just melting. You're essentially just burning through electrons like a wild man.
Yeah.
And then on the way when we were going through the mountains, because we weren't driving some crazy amount, and on the way down, when you are regenerative braking, the maximum it'll send 220 kilowatts back to the battery. So it's got a pretty good regenerative braking system. It's got one pedal braking. It has adaptive braking, which I did not like until this car. So they have adaptive regenerative braking, which I've used on the iX and the i4. And I talked to them, and they're like, yeah, they've probably updated. We've been updating stuff. So I believe that they've updated, because on the iX and the i4 that I've driven, it always felt inconsistent. The way it works is like adaptive cruise control. You know, as you come to a car, it'll slow down. With adaptive braking, it determines, like, based on the vehicles in front of you and the road conditions and the road itself, how much regenerative braking that it'll implement. And it always felt a little like, sometimes I'm like, oh, it'll do a lot of regenerative braking, and it didn't. And then sometimes it did a lot more than I anticipated. But now with the iX M60, it feels like they've done it better. And this was a pre-production model, so I'm guessing it probably has the latest software for that. So something that I didn't like, I actually ended up using for most of the drive So good job, BMW, for making something that I didn't like. Actually kind of like.
I actually like now.
So they, actually, I kind of like in less than a year.
Sounds like they probably reduced or limited how much it can change from based on the conditions so it's more consistent.
Yeah, and I think that they just fine tune on how the roads and there's a corner coming up, let's adjust this. Oh, let's just all these over the air updates. I mean, your car's just. It's evolving while it's in the driveway.
Excellent.
Just evolves while you sleep.
There's you get up in the morning, there's an update, and you're like, hey, what new thing do I have now? They're like, oh, we gave you a new sticker.
All right. Well, I had the Toyota Tundra 4x4 Limited Crew Max 5.5. So that is that's the new Tundra. The completely redesigned Tundra that came out last year, four-wheel drive, Crew Max, the crew cab, and this is the one with the shorter 5.5-foot bed. You can also get it with a 6.5-foot bed. And this one is, this year for the new Tundra, it's only got two powertrain options. In the past, they've had a naturally aspirated V6 and a V8 engine. This year, they've kind of gone down the Ford route and ditched the naturally aspirated engines altogether. So you have the option of either a 3.5-liter twin-turbo V6 that has 389 horsepower and 479 pounds-feet of torque, which is, I think, slightly less power and slightly more torque than the similar 3.5-liter EcoBoost in an F-150. But overall, it's not a whole lot of difference between the two. They're pretty comparable. The other option is that same engine with a hybrid. And it's a similar type of hybrid architecture to what you get with the F-150, where the motor is in between the engine and the transmission in place of the torque converter. I had the non-hybrid version. Which was interesting to have, right after having the hybrid F-150. And I talked about the F-150 last time. The fuel economy I got with the hybrid F-150 was not particularly impressive. It fell well short of the label value, 23 miles per gallon. I got I had like 19.5 with that one. This Tundra is rated at 17 miles per gallon city, 22 highway, 19 combined. And I got just over 17 with it. So it also fell well short. And I wasn't driving it particularly aggressive. And I didn't haul any mulch this time.
No mulch.
It really even a test?
I know. Did you even drive it, Sam?
I did. I drove it to go to Farmington Hills to drive the new Nissan Z.
Fair.
I did a fair amount of driving with it, driving around town, some highway driving. And, the fuel economy was just, kind of unimpressive, considering, part of the reason for, going with these, more modern engines is they're supposed to be more fuel efficient. And frankly, it was not that efficient.
Is it because the engine isn't that efficient, or is it because they decided to do what everyone else has done and essentially just put a billboard on the front of their truck, therefore defying all logic when it comes to aerodynamics?
Well, there is that. I'm sure that's part of it. But, that factors into the EPA label values, too. And, couldn't even manage to match that. So one of the weird things about this is this is one of the first non-hybrid Toyota vehicles that I've had that has auto stop start. And usually when you have a vehicle with auto stop start, when the system is engaged, when the vehicle comes to a stop and you've got your foot on the brake, the engine turns off. When you take your foot off the brake, the engine restarts. No problem. What was strange with this one is if in normal driving conditions, you're usually not really hard on the brake. You put your foot on the brake, you're coasting down to a stop, and vehicle stops. You would expect the auto stop start to switch off the engine. In fact, what comes on, there's a message on the cluster, with a little icon, indicating the brake pedal and a foot on the brake pedal. And if you want the engine to stop, you actually have to press down harder on the brake pedal to get the engine to stop. And then you have to hold it down, because if you release that pressure at all, and it's a fair amount of pressure to get the engine to shut off. And it, as soon as you let up on that brake pressure at all, the engine restarts, which is really kind of a strange system. That's a weird, strange, lazy
workaround.
Yeah. You know, I think it seems like what they're trying to do, because a lot of people don't like auto stop start. And so most manufacturers.
A lot of people. Just, does anybody not? Who doesn't hate it?
Well, it doesn't.
I don't. It depends on the vehicle. On some vehicles, it's fine.
Like mild hybrids, it's totally fine.
Yeah.
On hybrids, it's totally fine. Because the electric engine starts you moving before the. So the electric motor keeps. Get you going, and then the engine catches up.
Yeah.
On regular cars, it's sort of like,
On most vehicles with auto stop start, the manufacturers will put a switch, that lets you disable it. So if you don't want it, you just hit the switch, and it disables it. In this case, they've done this in order to try to give you on-demand disable capability. So if you don't press hard on the brake pedal, it's not going to shut off the engine. And if you want it to shut off the engine, you have to basically press harder, which seems like a weird way to go. And I think most people are probably never going to press that hard on the brake pedal and hold it down while the truck is stopped at an intersection or a red light, long enough to actually keep the engine off. So that was a little strange. Other stuff, like it's got the Toyota Safety Sense 2 ADAS package, so it's got adaptive cruise control, lane centering, blind spot monitoring, all that good stuff. All that worked fine, works really well. No issues there. The infotainment is the latest generation of Toyota's infotainment system, which we've talked about before. It's a much, much, much improved version system from the previous Entune systems. The interface is much nicer. It's got a 14-inch center touchscreen. It's got support for wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. There's a wireless charging pad, a Qi charging pad for charging your phone, so you can put it down on there. One thing that I complained about before when we drove the Toyota bZ4X is that with this system, when you're using, basically you can only get one thing up on the screen at a time, even though you've got a 14-inch display that could easily show you, nav multiple. And your media player controls, you can't do that. You can see the map, or you can see the media player controls, or you can see, your other settings. But only one of those. Pick one.
Choose one. One right. And only one.
If the old Entune was so bad, we should just be happy.
Oh, no, you're right. I mean, this is a huge, huge improvement. Absolutely. No complaint there. And the voice control actually works pretty well with this one. And, cool. When I drove the bZ4X, I asked them about this kind of weird setup where, you can't show two things on the screen at once. And they said, you can just use voice, to pause the music, while you've got the nav up. Things like that, or to change the volume. So that to their credit, that stuff actually does work pretty well on here. It's not a total loss. For me, I like to have the media player controls and the map up there at the same time. And if you use Android Auto or CarPlay, that's actually what you get. So I've got a screenshot.
I keep hitting that little button until it shows all three things. And I'm like, there you go.
Yeah.
Now I can see what I'm listening to. I can see my directions. No, that's
you want to see everything all at once?
Yeah.
All the things.
Yep. So, that's a relatively minor quibble, because I think the reality is most people probably are going to have their phone connected and use that. The design. We've talked about it before. It's very, very designed. It's very styled.
It's designed.
This is not a dull looking truck. You know, the grill, well, you know, if you don't like BMW's new grills, you're probably not going to be a big fan of this one either.
Oh my God.
It's ginormous.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of grill. Aside from that, most of the rest of it, you know, the truck actually drives really well. I thought, you know, in most instances, I found that the ride quality was actually slightly better than what I got with the F-150. And you know, the Tundra does have coil spring rear suspension like the Ram 1500s do. So that's, I think that helps. You know, it felt very stable. Steering felt decent. It's very roomy. It doesn't have, you know, some of the cool features that you get on the F-150, like the Pro Power on board, with all the plugs in the bed, things like that. You can't get that on here. And you know, no fancy tailgates or steps in the tailgate, things like that. It's more basic, you know, when it comes to some of those features. But overall, the things that Toyota has done, they've, you know, aside from the styling, they've generally executed quite well on. So the Tundra starts at about $35,000 for the extended cab, short bed, rear wheel drive. The limited Crew Max four wheel drive that I had with the TRD package on there came to a grand total of let's see, gotta pull this up and scroll over, $60,188.
$60,000 and doesn't have a little step in the bed.
No. the well, hey, it's cheaper than the $83,000 F-150 hybrid Platinum I had.
That's so true.
So take. How much do you think it costs to ship this thing from San Antonio to wherever your local Toyota dealer is?
$1,995. $1,450.
Robbie wins again.
$1,695. Yeah. Dang it! I'm gonna make him go first next time. I'm just gonna go lower.
That's a good. Yeah, that's what you want to be at the end.
You're
of the
cheating.
Thing. You want to be at the end. Then you can be $1. $1.
What? Oh, $1. I guess one other thing about the way this thing looks. You know, it did have the $3,000 TRD off-road package, which has big 20-inch wheels and everything, but it doesn't sit particularly high. Like a lot of times, you know, like if you get a Sierra AT4 or an F-150 Tremor or something like that, they seem to sit quite a bit higher, and this one did not. I forgot to check what the ground clearance is, but it seems like it sits quite a bit lower on its wheels than most other full-size trucks with an off-road package do. But you know, that's neither here nor there. So that's the 2022 Tundra Limited.
I mean, it doesn't have a fancy tailgate, but you know, in like 40 years, this thing will still be running.
So. That's true. Yeah, I mean, you'll as long as you change the oil and stuff, this thing will probably run a million miles without too much difficulty.
It will never die.
Until the end of time.
Until the end of time, you'll have it forever.
Or a tree falls on it.
No, it'll still go.
Yeah. It's not gonna it'll stop just it. Have a big dent. It'll go. It'll just go a little crooked.
Keep going. It's just shake it off. Shake it off.
Yeah. Okay.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Let's see, what else we got this week? Porsche showed off a new Cayman GT4 in Europe called the 718 Cayman GT4 E-Performance. This is an electric version of the Cayman GT4. All, you know, I think in max power mode, puts out a little over 1,000 horsepower. You know, this is basically using the electric powertrain stuff that they had in the Mission R concept last year. And this thing is really fast. Apparently, it's got comparable performance to a GT3 Cup car, a 911 GT3 Cup. And with the battery that's in there, It will run for about 30 minutes, which is long enough to run a typical 911 Cup GT3 Cup race. And it sounds like there's a pretty decent chance that they might build these and do another single make series like the 911 Cup Carrera Cup series.
So you're going to buy one?
Probably not.
No?
No, I don't think my pockets are quite deep enough to swing this one.
I don't think many pockets are deep enough to quite swing this one. Most pockets are far too shallow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
But apparently, I guess the next generation Cayman and Boxster are going to be electric. They're ditching the internal combustion engines and are going electric. And so this is kind of a preview of what to expect from those. And the link to the story in the drive that I'll have in the show notes includes a video from Chris Harris where he got to drive this thing. And he was quite impressed. He liked it a lot.
I can imagine. I mean, the Taycan is so great. And the idea that they're going to put this on in a Cayman and the Boxster, you're just like, okay, well, if anyone's not going to mess this up, it's going to be Porsche. They're going to exactly. Make sure that when you get into that, get Cayman, the electric Cayman, it's going to be a Cayman. It's going to be exactly what you expect it to be. It's just going to be electric. Just it'll be a little bit quieter and have a lot more torque.
Yeah.
A lot. Well,
I mean, actually, if you watch the video in here, this thing actually makes a fair bit of noise, but it's not like traditional Porsche boxer engine noise.
Right.
You know, it sounds more like a Formula E car. It's got that whine.
I talked to Lamborghini about this and about sound, and they're trying to figure out for their first electric Lamborghini how to do sound that's natural from an electric motor. They don't want to have piped in sound. They're trying to figure out how to make
a noisy electric motor.
Yeah, like a noisy electric motor that for Lamborghini. So they're still working on it. They don't know exactly what they're going to do, but it's something that they're actually researching. So I can see if that works out for Lamborghini, if it comes out and everyone's like, ooh, then I think other automakers will probably start looking into it. And you know, since Porsche and Lamborghini are both owned by the Volkswagen group, I could see Porsche being like, well, if they figure it out, we can just tweak it to our own needs.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Honda released a teaser image of the 2024 Prologue, their first new EV for North America. It's a SUV. Can't tell if it's a three-row or a two-row. Looks like it's, you know, roughly pilot-sized. And this is going to be built by GM along with an Acura on the same platform, on the GM Ultium platform. What do you guys think of this?
Is this just this one image, or am I missing something else in here?
Just the one image.
Okay, this is a weird image, or the car is weird. That's what I think.
It does look like it's got a very low greenhouse and a very long hood.
Okay, you've ever taken a picture of a car and you mean to edit it down, like to chop out the sides and then like extraneous images on the side of your vehicle when you take a picture and you accidentally forget to tell it to keep its like, don't stretch it out really long. Don't make it really fat. Yeah. It looks like you did that. It went whoop and you stretched it like 4 feet in either direction. Like, oh no, wait, undo that. Let's get back real proper car dimensions and just try. It looks like you just squished, you like took your hand on the roof and you went swoosh and then the edges went beep out the side. I'm not wrong. That's what it looks like.
No, you're right.
It looks like a fisheye lens.
Yeah, it doesn't look right.
Like a wide angle.
Why would they do that? That's one of those things when you do it and you take a picture, you're like, whoops. Image.
It's a teaser image.
Yeah, it's a sketch. I mean, it's not even a full CGI render of it. Yeah.
I can't. No.
The front end looks kind of like the new Civic.
Yeah.
Does it?
I wish they'd made a Prelude instead.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm with you. Prelude. Yay.
But you know, everyone's going to
it's
probably not going to be. I don't think it'll be a third row. I think it'll be a two row because they're trying to, you know, Volkswagen wouldn't bring the ID.3 over here because they wanted to make sure that the first vehicle they got over here sold a lot. And Honda, I mean, Honda got rid of the Fit just so they could get more CR-V sales. The Fit was doing pretty well, but it wasn't an SUV. So, yeah they're going to go for that.
I would bet it's a two-row.
They're going to go for that that sweet spot, small two-row SUV that everyone, or at least that's what they're hoping everyone will buy. And, I will just say that I'm very sad that they referenced the e-Honda in the first paragraph of this press release.
Yeah. But they referenced it, but they won't sell it
Honda
to us.
Honda E. I'm sorry, not e-Honda. e-Honda's the guy from Street Fighter 2. Yeah. The Honda E, about the same size, by the way. Honda E. e-Honda and the Honda E are about the same size. They referenced the Honda E in the first paragraph of this press release, and they were refused to bring it over here. And I'm still very, very bitter about that.
You're bitter, angry.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first bullet point on here, styling completed at Honda Design Studio in Los Angeles shows hint of Honda E. This thing doesn't look anything like a Honda E.
Nope.
And if you're so proud of the Honda E, make it global. Come on.
Yeah.
Don't be like that, Honda. Don't do us like that.
Don't do that.
Or how about, I don't know, a refresh of the Honda E with Ultium? I don't know, something. Just bring us a second gen. They're never going to bring it. We're going to get this instead. This is going to be the first. And Honda's super, super conservative about what they'll sell and won't sell. And it has to sell 1 bazillion units in order for them to keep it on the market.
Is that an official? Can you give a source for the 1 bazillion units, Roberto?
It's in Wikipedia.
It's from e-Honda. From e-Honda, the guy from Street Fighter 2.
Nicely done.
The thousand hand slap. He's like, by the way, we have to stay a thousand hand slap, gazillion cars sold.
A gazillion cars that we're not building yet.
We could have a Honda Fit hybrid right now, but we don't. Think how nice that would be. Honda Fit. It's like a TARDIS. There's room on the inside than you think.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's sad, but not enough Americans want to buy those.
They would have sold. No, they did sell. They sold a lot of them. They just didn't sell as many.
Yeah. They didn't sell I forgot the number already. Bazillion, was that?
Bazillion.
They did not sell the clear bazillion required to make it a profitable
vehicle. When you think about it now with gas prices being so high. Like the Honda Fit, like once if the dealers were selling them, like, oh, by the way, you can put all the stuff you can put on a CRV, you can put in the back of this car as well. People are like, oh, and I could save gas? Oh. No.
So speaking of small EVs, the Nissan Sakura, or Sakura, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. This is electric K car that Nissan has just launched, along with Mitsubishi in Japan. What do you guys think of this one?
It's so cute.
They need to bring this car to the United States.
It's so little.
Done. Just bring it here. Okay, it's. Price below $14,000 in Japan. Let's say all the stuff they have to do it to make it American, it goes up to, I don't know, $16,000-$17,000. Then you put the tax credit on it. You could get an EV that has, and what are they saying, 112 miles of range, 90 miles of range, EPA. They just cruise around town.
You guys, this little tiny roller skate, which is adorable, it has 63 horsepower.
63 horsepower.
And it has a turning radius of 15.7 feet.
It'll go 80 miles an hour. It's the cutest little thing.
You could do a U-turn in a typical residential street.
U-turn in the back of the Toyota Tundra.
Yeah, almost.
You could. Just right in the bed.
I think there is a market for these really tiny cars in the United States if you can get them. $14,000.
That is cheap.
And if here, it's, you know, it's going to be more expensive because they bring
right,
it here.
Right, but still.
Whatever. But you throw the tax credit on that, I think a lot of people would be very happy. Would be like, oh, I can get a little EV that just for driving around town that I could go to the store and pick stuff up in. I can throw the dogs in the back. I can pick the kids up from school for under $10,000.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to the Mini Cooper SE, which also has 110-mile range. But it costs more than twice as much.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this range is WLTP, so this is not a real range. This is a fake.
Well, still, I mean,
so I'm gonna say like 85 miles of range.
Probably closer to 90, maybe 95.
Well, I'll be speeding everywhere. Yeah. It's got sport mode.
Well, it's only
speeding
got
everywhere.
It's only got 63 horsepower.
You can't speed. Yeah. I mean, the most you can get is 80. You can't even get the go as fast as the car will let you. Your speeding ticket's still not that bad.
Yeah. Think of all the money. And you're going to save money on electricity, right? Because it's only got like a 20 kilowatt hour pack. So it charges in like a second.
And a half a second. Yep.
You're not
gonna, charged.
The cost of the car is under $10,000. And you're never going to get a ticket because there's no way you're going to...
You can't go that fast.
Everything. Why don't we have this? Come on.
Why don't we have this? This would be fun. Do you think they'll give it to us? No.
No.
Not
a snowball's chance.
Yeah. Somebody coming up behind it in a Tundra will never even see it. They'll just drive right over it.
Yeah, but they can't see me in my BRZ either in their Tundra.
That's true.
To be fair. Or a Mini Cooper or a...
Yeah.
That's more of a problem with the trucks than with us.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. All right. A new documentary came out on Friday on Hulu. It was published by the New York Times, and it's called Elon Musk's Crash Course. Did either of you have a chance to watch it?
No, nah, I was in Europe.
No, I did not.
Okay. Well, I did. I got a screener for it
and
watched it. They spend a lot of time talking to Joshua Brown's friends. Joshua Brown is the guy who died in the first... he was the first known fatality in an autopilot crash. Back in May of 2016, a semi, was made a left turn in front of him. He was in autopilot and not paying attention. And the system did not recognize that the truck was not a bridge. And just kept right on driving at 70 plus miles an hour, and sliced the top off the car, turned it into a convertible. And there have been multiple other crashes over the years where people have died while using autopilot. The director, you know, the filmmakers, you know, they talked to a few former Tesla autopilot engineers. They talked to Neil Badette and Cade Metz from the Times, both very good reporters. I know both of them, you know, the stuff they said, absolutely spot on. But, you know, they also spent, I think, an inordinate amount of time talking about Josh Brown, you know, and talking with his friends about, you know, why he was so gung-ho on testing autopilot and everything. You know, it's like, it doesn't, none of that matters. You know, it's irrelevant to the story, really. And, you know, they did talk to Robert Sumwalt, the former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, and another member of the board whose name escapes me at the moment. You know, and when, after the Josh Brown crash, you know, NTSB and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration did an extensive investigation into what happened. And, you know, the NTSB, as we've said before, they don't have any regulatory authority or enforcement authority. They're an investigative body that looks into accidents with aviation, rail, marine, and ground vehicles. And then they investigate and make recommendations. And they made a bunch of really good recommendations after this crash. Like, systems like this should be geofenced to divided highways only. They should have robust driver monitor systems. And, you know, there was a bunch of other things, but those are probably the two most important. And they talked to the NTSB, you know, and they talked about, you know, what their recommendations were, but the only person they talked to from NHTSA was the former communications director there. And he didn't say much and didn't really defend why NHTSA, you know, basically did nothing, and why, you know, for in the NHTSA report, you know, they actually cited data that they got from Tesla that autopilot reduced incidents of crashes by 40%, which, you know, they didn't actually get the full raw data from Tesla. And by the time that somebody did, you know, was able to go through the whole Freedom of Information Act request, or rather they got the data from Tesla, but they didn't publish it. They only published the, you know, that statement that it reduced crashes by 40%. And somebody, you know, was doing an investigation into that and spent like 2.5 years trying to get that data from NHTSA when they finally got it, they started diving into it and published a big long report on it. And it turns out it was all bogus. Most of the data was useless, and you know what data there was that actually demonstrated, you know, how effective autopilot was versus non-autopilot, actually showed that it had more crashes rather than less. You know, the filmmakers really missed an opportunity to really look into what happened at NHTSA. Why did NHTSA not do anything back in 2016 when they had the opportunity to, and subsequently still hasn't done anything, and even up until now when we're still having crashes of vehicles with autopilot. So, I think that was a real missed opportunity by the filmmakers to look into that.
I went to the NTSB final conclusion of the Tesla accident where the gentleman was driving a Model X.
And the Walter Wong crash?
Yeah, the Walter Wong crash. And it kept like trying to drag him into this exit lane. It's on the left-hand side along the I think it was the 280 or the 101, doesn't it?
It's 280.
280. And so, you know, we went through the whole, you know, proceeding. They told everything that had happened. And at the end of it, NTSB could not be more irritated with NHTSA. They spent, after they did the whole thing, then they spent, like, a good 20 minutes just saying, we can't do anything about this. We can just tell you what happened. NHTSA is doing absolutely nothing. And then they brought up, like, NHTSA tweets. And there was like tweets about, oh, you should be buying a car. They're like, it's not NHTSA's job to sell cars for people. It's NHTSA's job to keep you safe on the road. So the NTSB is not happy with NHTSA. It wasn't happy. This is 2020. I don't know. It was before, I know it was before March 2020. So January and February 2020, went all the way to Washington, D.C. for this. And it's true. It's this sort of like, well, I think there was this reticence to do anything because there was this concern that you were going to be stifling innovation. Oh, we're stifling innovation. And that's not really what's ever happened in any of these things where there's no one stifling innovation. They've allowed these companies to run without regulation. And the result is we've had all these issues because everyone was like afraid there were, you know, every administration for the last, you know, three or four administrations have been concerned about stifling innovation. And the reality is that there has to be a framework that keeps people safe and, you know, and none of it was actually or ever has stifled any innovation.
Yeah. And in fact, it's the exact opposite. You know, when they started putting safety regulations on cars, that's what led to a ton of innovation. I mean, we've had enormous amount of innovation over the last 50 years since they started regulating automotive safety. And, you know, I mean, that's why we have airbags and, you know, the kinds of seat belts we have today and the kinds of crash structures we have today and electronic stability controls and all this other stuff is because of regulation, not despite it. So I think that's always been a bogus argument as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, all these people are very smart that are building these systems. And if they're smart enough to build a system, they're smart enough to build them so that they work within a regulatory framework and they keep people safe. Mm-hmm. I mean, none of these people are like, oh, no, we have to. I mean, Super Cruise is geofenced. It's not like that's something that's difficult to do. Blue Cruise is geofenced. None of this stuff is, I mean, it may be difficult, but these people are smart, or at least they say they're smart. So
they are reportedly smart.
Reportedly, allegedly, and at least they've told us time and time again how very smart they are.
They keep reminding us. Especially those in Silicon Valley. They never let us forget how smart they are.
Oh my God, don't even get me started on
so very, very, very smart.
When I was a tech reporter, everyone told me they were changing the world. And there's nothing quicker, you know, after like the second, I'm like, wait, the last people just told me they were changing the world. You can't all be changing the world. And they
can't all be doing this. Who's lying?
Eventually, yeah, I ended up not. I did not have a lot of fans in many companies.
All right. When you got to Lake Como last week, you got to spend some time at the Concorso dell'Eleganza. What'd you see?
I saw a lot of cars. Surprise.
No.
No, sucker. It was a very, like, I've been to Pebble Beach a bunch of times, and that's really the only concourse I've been to. Actually, not just really. That is the only concourse I've ever been to, is Pebble Beach. It's near my house, sort of. And there's news around it, so I'll go. This one's a lot. I actually preferred it over Pebble Beach because it was a more intimate affair. It was a lot smaller. There were fewer vehicles. There weren't like 60 Studebakers. I'm like, okay, I got it. You guys bought a bunch of goddamn Studebakers. there's actually like one of each cool car. So yeah, so I went. It was very nice. It's very exclusive, and very fancy. Which, if you probably listen to the podcast, I am neither of those things.
You are the fanciest. Well, you are
totally exclusive. There is no one else like you, Robbie.
I guess there's that, but it's I'm also, yeah, I'm not very fancy. I got really excited because there was a, on the way to go look at something, there was a Piaggio Porter, which is a very tiny, like, minivan. It's very, very tiny. And I was like, oh, look at this Piaggio Porter. Also, it's a Piaggio. So mostly when in this country, when you think Piaggio, you think scooters. But you can get a little Piaggio minivan. And it's delightful. It is a delightful little vehicle. But for the most part, yeah, no, there's a Mercedes or BMW was one of the main, sponsors. So there's a lot of BMWs, 2002s. There was the 700 RS, the M1. There was Karl Lagerfeld. Karl Lagerfeld's 7 Series there. He had one specially made. It was a little bit stretched. It had like a fax machine in it or something, someone told me. I don't know. I kept trying to look in the window. It was all darkened in the back for a fax machine. Instead, I just saw like 2 or 3 CD players. His car was there. I guess he had it for a little while. Then he gave it back to BMW. There was the, a couple M1s. There was a, Meyer Manx, which wasn't in the show. It was just parked a lot, like someone had driven it there. So I just took a picture of that.
Did you see the, Aston Martin Bulldog?
I did see the Aston Martin Bulldog. That thing is cool. They're actually working on making, cause that's supposed to have a top speed of 200 miles an hour. And it, of course, it never went 200 miles an hour, but
hell, until recently, it barely went at all.
Yeah. So the person who bought it is apparently they're trying to get it up to 200 miles an hour, and wow. So they're working on getting it going. And you can go on my Instagram, STRNGWYS. That's my Instagram handle, same as Twitter. So I have a lot of pictures, including the Bulldog. I put the Bulldog, they finally opened up the back so you can see the engine bay. So I put that in my Instagram stories, but I'll put it up. I'll throw it up on my main feed so you guys can look at the engine bay. It's very pretty. There's a bunch of, there's a De Tomaso and, an 004CS. There's a lot of like really ridiculous, crazy cars that you sort of see at this thing. But a lot of really, really nice old vehicles. I mean, there's a bunch of SLs. I feel like SLs, even though one just sold for like $1 billion, $125 million or whatever.
I think 143.
Wow.
143. There's still a lot of SLs in the world because every car thing I go to, hey, there's an SL. Hey, there's an SL. Everyone loves an SL, by the way. I've driven an SL. It's fantastic. There were some Ferraris there. One of my most favorite Ferraris is the one that doesn't look like a Ferrari. It just looks like an odd little car, which is the 250 GT Zagato. It's a 56. It's just a little blue two-seater. And over the driver and the passenger's head, there's like a little bubble. But in the middle, it's like in the roof. I don't know. It's just a fun little weird little car. I like this. I like the 50s era Ferraris a lot because they're just like these little compact, like, fun machines.
I like that yellow SL Roadster.
Yeah, the SL Roadster is really... That thing was bright. Yeah. I think it burned my eyes.
Is it as bright as your blue car?
It's brighter. It was brighter than the blue car. There's an Aston Martin. There was a DB8. There was this Lancia there that I really liked. And it had, like, both wheels, both the front and the rear wheels, had little half covers, little half spats on it. And it was the B Junior. Atlantia is an Italian car company that no one in America probably knows about. Anyway, it was just like this fun little weird little.
They haven't sold Lancias here since the 70s, I think.
Yeah. It's just.
I didn't even know they ever sold them here, so I just learned something. I knew that they knew they existed. I never knew they were even in the United States. So there you go.
Yeah. No, they had. I actually have a piece. How many cars were there? I don't know. A bunch. I guess there's a number, but I don't have it.
I think you're right, though. The Piaggio Porter is definitely the winner of the show.
Yeah. See? That's what I think.
That's the best in show.
Instead, it was like an old something. I'll tell you the winner. Hold on. I had it and I forgot it. I think it was, it was Bugatti. The Bugatti, a 1937 Bugatti 57S. It was one of the Class A cars. Class A and Class B, I'm always just like, They all remind me of Cruella de Vil or like gangster movies or the Nazis. There's like three things that come to mind when I think about Class A and Class B. So I'm always just like, I'm like, I saw 101 Dalmatians. It was fine. People spend so much money on those vehicles. They're like little pieces. They're little works of art because they put so much work into them. But I don't know, for some reason, I think I've seen them so many times at Pebble Beach, and I'm just like,
just not impressed.
I don't know. I guess I don't feel like they get driven very much. I feel like they're very much. These are cars that someone sticks in a room, and they never leave that room outside of going to one of these events. And to me, I mean, that's just
is sad.
Yeah, which is kind of sad. And I feel like some of these other vehicles, like they'll drive. I mean, not a lot, but they'll every once in a while they'll take them out and drive them and really, open them up to all 80 horsepower that they have. Because old cars don't have a lot of power.
Oh, this I just pulled up a photo of this Bugatti, and it's interesting because it's actually not restored.
Oh yeah, it looks like someone pushed it down a hill.
Yeah, it looks like a 100-year-old car.
It does. It's like it's leathery. I mean, it looks cool, but at the same time, you're like, okay. I mean, it's like I bought an old, you found a Warhol, like, that has a little bit of mold on it and stuff. And you're like, well, there's a couple scratches, maybe the thing. You're like, oh, well, but it's like his first Warhol.
It's still a Warhol,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's still a Warhol. So you keep it and you put it up and then you just...
You hide it in a room until you
show it at an exhibition.
I like, old cars like this, with the patina, I don't know, something about, having a, 70, 80, 90-year-old car that, looks like it's brand new, just doesn't seem right.
Feels wrong. It should look like it's seen a little bit of something.
Yeah.
Are you looking at this or are you looking at the 59 Sports, the Type 59?
No, I'm looking at the Type 57S that won.
Okay. Because the Type 59 Sport S, or
the black one with the yellow stripe down the side.
Hold on. I get the little thing. Boop, ba-doop, ba-doop.
He has to look things up now.
No, that's a different one.
Oh, is it?
The Type 57. Here. That's like a Cruella de Vil car. It wasn't even the cool one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it wasn't
this
even
is,
the
cool. This is the one I'm looking at.
Let me see.
I just dropped it in the chat. Yeah, this
we'll put
one
a picture
cool.
in the thing. Yeah, this is the. Yeah, wait, is this the one? 57S. Wait, is this? I'm looking at this book. Oh, is this book wrong?
59. Well, there might have been.
Did they put the wrong car up?
Well, no, it says along with this one, there was a 1934 Type 59 race car and a 37 Type 57 Stelvio.
Okay, yeah. So
which is the one that you just showed us.
Yeah.
So I think this one that looks like it's all beat up, I think is the one that won.
59. Hold on, I'm looking at my email. 57S. 57S. I'm going to do some investigating.
We'll answer it next show. We'll argue over who actually won.
No, I don't think... Or is my book wrong? Oh, this is 57C. Sorry. That's my problem. There's my issue. Sorry. I was looking at the 57C. No wonder I was being... I was like, well, I don't know why this car won at all. Wait, this one says 59. Huh. Oh, well. Anyway.
An
old car that none of us can afford won. An old car that none of us can... It's always the same. It's always Class A and Class B that win as well. That's my other thing. I'm just like, meh. I voted for the Ferrari to be... I'm the only person I think who voted for it. I'm like, I don't care. I'm voting for the Ferrari. We all got the vote, so that was nice. But I know that I don't know anyone there because I don't know a lot of rich people, unfortunately. But if I did, I would have got them to vote for the Ferrari.
Oh, you know, I think the one that you just showed us is I found another thing here is actually the one that won, not the one that I found. So.
Oh, okay.
Anyway. So,
I think the DuPont Registry messed up is what we're saying.
Yes, I think you're probably right.
Which,
frankly, wouldn't surprise me all that much.
That's fine. But I used to buy the DuPont Registry all the time when I was a kid. And then we would look at the weird cars that were for sale. Because there would always be like the old, and then there'd be like a Geo Metro with like a V8 in it. Just like insane, weird things that people, like monsters that people had Frankenstein together. They're like, here's a Fiero with a V12. Like, how did that even, you got to sit in another car in order to drive it.
Okay. Let's answer a few listener questions that have come in the past hour. We finally got some. Let's start off with Andrew Pappas. How long until we get touchscreens on the steering wheel? Real issue. Cars get more and more safety tech, but deaths keep rising. My thought is that cars are too isolating and poor visibility combined with safety tech being a crutch is the problem. Can the tide be turned at all?
Well, I think we're looking at our phones too much, and I think some people are looking at that display as well too often.
Yeah,
I mean, people are still. If you ride a motorcycle, if you drive a car, you're like, oh, I'm sure lots of people look at the phone. If you ride a motorcycle and you sit a little higher, you're looking down in the cars. Everyone is on their goddamn phones all the time. It's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I've been driving even here in Michigan. You know, there was one time I was driving down the highway and some guy in a Model 3. I saw him coming up behind me, and you know, I stayed over to the right. And as he was going by, I looked over, and he was sitting there looking down at his phone, texting. You know, while he was in autopilot mode, wasn't looking at the road, wasn't touching the steering wheel. It was terrible.
That's bad.
And that's the craziest part, because they're like, "Well, I'll hide it by putting it down and then looking down." We all know you're on your phone.
Yeah, it makes it even worse. Like you're holding it down so a cop can't see you. What do they think you're like staring at your crotch doing? Like what? Like
oh, no.
I was over at Magna last Friday for a demo of their latest driver monitor system. Along with several other suppliers, they're also working with Seeing Machines, the company that supplies the tech that's used by GM and Super Cruise. And what they've done, what Magna's done, is they've integrated it into the rearview mirror. So it's actually a higher resolution version of the infrared camera that Seeing Machines has developed, and updated version of the software. So it not only is it looking at eye gaze, and head pose, but it's also looking at the driver's mouth. So, for example, it can recognize, for example, if the driver is yawning. So if they're tired or they yawn, it'll recognize that and can give you an alert saying, "Hey, you know, maybe it's time to take a break." Of course, it'll also recognize if you're looking down at the phone or, you know, looking off at one of the passengers or something else. If you're not watching the road, you know, it can give you those kinds of alerts. So, you know, we're going to see more and more capable driver monitor systems coming to market. But to part of Andrew's question about touchscreens in the steering wheel, did either of you two ever see the interior of the Byton M-Byte?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. That was a bad idea. There's nothing
bad,
good.
Bad, 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 bad.
It had a touchscreen in the steering wheel.
Yeah.
I remember I asked them about airbags, and they're like, "Oh, we have it so set up so it'll like
went
down or something."
Yeah,
like that.
I actually went for a ride, but you know, before they shut down their office in San Jose, I visited them a few years back and went for a ride in a prototype and spent some time in the studio with their interior designer, their head of user experience design, in their interior buck going through all that stuff. And the way they had it set up is, you know, where you typically have the airbag module, the steering wheel spokes actually angled back and attached to the steering column behind this module, behind the airbag module. So that what you actually had is the top half of it was a touchscreen, and then the bottom half was the airbag. And it didn't rotate. So when you turn the steering wheel, that part stayed where it was. And the reason why they had it that way is because, you know, it also had this big, massive pillar-to-pillar screen, you know, like a 49-inch screen.
Oh, yeah, that giant screen.
That was set back away from you, so you couldn't actually reach it to touch it. So the touchscreen in the steering wheel was actually the interface, the control interface, to control stuff on that screen. It was an interesting concept.
It's super awkward because you're pulling your arm in and then moving it over. So now you look like a T-Rex and you're trying.
Well, there was also a couple of knobs on the side.
Yeah, they had knobs for the thumb.
Yeah, you can scroll with your thumbs and stuff like that.
Yeah, I remember it just being sort of odd. And then I don't think it was an improvement over the straight arm trying to use the infotainment system, which isn't that great, because especially when you have a super complex for no damn reason infotainment system, and you don't have anywhere to put your hand when you start bouncing around. Again, there's a lot of things you don't have to put in the infotainment system, people, like controls.
Well, fortunately, we won't have to worry about that one coming to market likely anytime in the foreseeable future, because M-Byte's been struggling to survive, and I don't think they'll ever get to production.
Yeah, sadly.
Or Byte, not M-Byte. M-Byte was the model.
Yeah.
All right. EXT Light asks, GM's ground-up strategy with the Silverado EV versus Ford's Hack-a-Chassis F-150 Lightning. What advantages will GM see, if any? We know the time to market isn't one. the tone of that question kind of implies that this person doesn't think what Ford has done is good.
I like that term, though. What was it again?
Hack-a-chassis.
Hack-a-chassis. It's like once upon a time there were hackathons. Now we're going to have, okay, build the next EV. Let's hack-a-chassis.
I mean, I think it's regardless of the platform, I mean, Ford's just sort of body on frame. It's a hack-a-chassis. By the way, I'm never going to stop using.
I'm going to use that all the time.
Ultium, I mean, when you look at what they're offering, I mean, the Ford offering it's already in market. and B, it feels more like what truck owners want, especially the commercial owners. The commercial owners, down to like the person who buys a truck for his one or two person contractor landscaping company. Whereas the Silverado's like, hey, it's all new and weird, so all the things you bought for the Silverado, they're not going to fit in this truck.
Yeah.
Womp, womp.
Yeah.
It's an avalanche. Womp, womp. It's just an avalanche.
It's just an avalanche.
Don't let GM hear you say that.
I was going to say, you're in trouble now.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be fine when it comes out, but it still looks like an avalanche.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is it's going to be another year before it arrives.
Which
F-150s are going to customers now. So, all right. Adam asks, besides a financial crisis, what would cause Sam to sell the Miata?
Yeah.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Well, only if somebody offered me one of, you know, a similar vintage with similar low miles in Mariner Blue. You know, I would do a straight-up trade for a Mariner Blue one. But that's about it.
So it's not even okay. So you just want a better.
So it's not even released.
I just want a different color.
No. I feel like I'm going to rephrase his question. What if to just sell it pure at the end, you're not replacing it with a better color?
Yeah, you have to sell
it. Not going
to
happen.
You have to sell it
and say goodbye to Miata forever.
Nope, not going to happen.
Okay, there you go. There's your answer. That's the real answer.
Yeah. That's the real answer. Like, Sam's on the streets. His family has disavowed his existence. But
he's sleeping in a Miata.
Out of the house. You know, there's enough room for me and my wife and the dog.
Is your wife aware of your retirement plan? I just think she should know.
Vaguely.
I don't think there's a glut of Miatas in the world, so it's not like it's ever going to be worth like $146 million or whatever that sell one for. So it's not going to be that.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
John W. Halkius asks, any insight to these random Tesla fires? None that I'm aware of. I don't know what's going on.
I mean, to be fair, all cars catch on fire.
Yeah. I mean, there's about 200,000 car fires a year in the U.S. Yeah. So,
gas cars, electric cars, hydrogen cars.
Cars catch fire.
NPG, the bus that had the crazy, like, flame shooting out of it. All vehicles.
Was that a CNG one?
CNG, that's the one, not MPG. I don't know,
MPG bus? What?
CNG, that CNG bus that from, I don't know, somewhere. That was on fire and flames were shooting out of it. Yeah, all vehicles have the potential to catch on fire, unless they're water-based. And I guess a bicycle, that's it.
Yeah. So, no, we don't have any insights onto these latest Tesla fires. Although I have seen a couple of different ones, you know, posted on Twitter in the last couple of days, so I have no idea what's going on. Paul Kavanaugh, final question. Why do automotive journalists use the term tank turn for what tankers refer to as a neutral steer turn? Come on, folks. Language matters.
I've never heard that thing. Also, tank turn, we all know it from video games. Playing tank games. Tank turn.
Because we want to use words that most people understand, and tank turn makes sense to a heck of a lot more people than whatever it was you just said, which I don't
neutral
even know.
Neutral steer turn.
Neutral steer. That's a SAM term. I love you, Sam. That's an engineering kind of like really specific, like there's a really easy way to say that. Tank turn. Or you tank can turn. Use the neutral steer turn.
You say tank turn, 99% of the people are going to know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Neutral steer turn is, I mean, they both mean the exact same thing.
Yes.
That's the fun thing. If one
the
of them
the simplest
didn't...
word to say what you need to say is normally the best word.
It's like autopilot. Like the most people assume that autopilot, how the word autopilot has evolved is that we all believe that autopilot means something runs automatically. This person was running on autopilot, which is why Tesla gets in trouble for autopilot. The reality is like on an airplane, autopilot isn't really autopilot. It's like something else.
It's basically cruise control.
Yeah, it's basically cruise control. But because this is what the word means, that's what the word means. It's like tank term.
Yeah. I mean, autopilot in an aircraft basically just maintains your speed and direction.
Yeah.
You know, until you change some settings. Mm-hmm. And so it's essentially just cruise control. It's not really, you know, autonomous flying.
Yeah, but as a society, we've come to use autopilot as something that's running on its own, which is this person was on autopilot just doing their job, which means they were doing it without thinking. It was just automatic. So, yeah.
All right. That's it for this week.
That's it.
Tank turns. And wait. Hack a chassis
and tank turns. That's the name of this episode.
The F-150 hack a chassis lightning.
Hack a chassis lightning. My Kona EV is a hack a chassis.
I'll mention that to Darren Palmer next time I talk to him. I'm sure he'll get a good laugh out of it.
What's going on with your hack a chassis?
Oh, that's all right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.